We greet each one this morning in the precious name of Jesus. I like to think of takeaways when we hear an opening and children's class and that. And isn't it amazing, the portion of scripture Dirk read, chapter 6. That's a fast-moving chapter if you read all the way through it. And it starts out with miracles and people wanting to make Jesus king, and in 56 verses, they want to kill him. Read through there and study what happened, and you'll see that you can be very popular if the bread's coming, and if the bread isn't coming and you begin to deal at a heart level with people, even ourselves, we begin to back off and close up, and the person keeps knocking at the door, and pretty soon we're ready to kill him. So, no, we wouldn't kill somebody, I know that, but it's not as nice as when they're blessing us, what we consider blessing. But when that stops and it starts getting more serious, then it's sometimes not met the same way. And in a fellowship, as brotherhood, you know, when the blessings are rolling and God's blessing and we're getting inspired and encouraged and blessing one another, that's wonderful. But there's another side to brotherhood. And that's concern for a brother. And we want to see the brotherhood thrive and want to see each individual in it thrive. And sometimes that takes words that are kind of like John 6. They go a little deeper than what we're comfortable going. So also on Brother Dirk's, I think one takeaway would be when we experience a blessing with the Lord, a hard situation that we're in, and He moves in such a mysterious way. I mean, we can't explain it away. Don't just think about how nice it was to eat the bread, but think, what's that mean about the person that did that? What's the real significance of what happened? And store that in the back of your mind so when you're out in a boat sometime and it's rough and Jesus is in the boat, we can understand if He tells us that beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. We don't start thinking, well, maybe it's because we don't have enough bread or we didn't bring the fragments we gathered. That's not a problem. Jesus is not very concerned about that. He can take care of that. He can take care of the natural. And He's mostly concerned about where is our trust. Are we trusting in Him or are we trusting in the fragments? Are we trusting in Him or are we trusting in the boat? Are we trusting on calm seas, or are we just trusting that He's here? We're under His control, and everything's fine, and we have a multitude of experiences to prove it. So experiences that don't prove that to us aren't worth a whole lot. They just feel good. So that we would learn, that I would learn from my past experiences, have a lot of rich ones, where in my mind there's no explanation that it turned out as well as it did, and God provided for me, and at the time I give credit. I say, oh, I think that person was sent by God. Or you're lost, and all of a sudden, there's the gate. Well, God moved me. So we can trust Him. We say we're trusting Him for our eternal salvation. Certainly we can trust Him for a meal or two, can't we? We don't have to get upset. I'm saying that to myself. Today things didn't go so well, and I really wasn't trusting Him. I was trusting to get here on time and go to prayer, and the car was making a noise, and I didn't know what it was. Stopped, checked the inflation and the tires. The rear one, left rear was a little low, so I filled that with air. Very practical thing. I figured that's it. Sorry, sound was there again. I didn't know whether to keep driving to church or stop or what. And I've been through situations like that before, and does God know I'm having a problem? Of course He does. And if I would have to pull off the side of the road and miss the meeting, would be God be in charge of that, or did something slip by God? You know, nothing slips by Him. Now, I can say that to you, but that's hard to keep hold of for me. But that's one of the things that are going to keep us on the right track as far as from Dirk's opening there. We need to learn from our past blessings, that He's well able to do exactly what He said He's going to do. He's overseeing our life. Now, that's easy to say, but it takes a definite choice on our part to put our mind in him, to look back in the boat and see he's there and say, let the winds blow and the waves rock. Nothing's going to happen he doesn't know about. Nothing will get by him. Beautiful thought for me. As you can see, I use a lot of time just talking on things that I've heard. And Brother David's children's class. Even a child is known by his doings. And what are we known by? Our profession, primarily. Unless our doings are so out of order that we'd start to say, hey, wait, this thing isn't lining up at all. And I'd like to present to you, too, my first answer when I was thinking of that would be, okay, children are known by their doings. What are we supposed to be known by? And I said, well, doings. And I thought, are we? Would God be fooled by us doing something? He goes much deeper with us as children of God. He knows the thoughts and intents of our heart. And some of the things we might be doing are really for other men's eyes to see. But God isn't put off by that. He knows exactly why we're doing what we're doing. We should do good, even if you don't feel like doing good. But God knows our hearts. So what we need to do, I think, when we have an opportunity to be a blessing, and we really don't feel like it, is do it anyway and just hold our hearts before God and say, Lord, I know what's right. I want to do right. Help me in my heart to be in line with that. So we're known by our doings, yes, but by God we're known by the motivations of our hearts. Is it to be seen? Or is it because it's the overflow of his grace in our life? So, I don't really know how understood all this will be, but in Bolivia last week, Brother Alfred he had a kidney removed. I want to go over this part pretty quickly. I probably won't, but I want to go over it quickly. I'm going to say 4 months ago, it might have been less, might have been a little more. He was having problems, and he went up into Santa Cruz, and they found cancer on a kidney, a growth on the kidney, and they removed it. It was cancer, but they thought they got it all. And he recovered some from that. But then he started getting weaker and came up a ways, and then he started getting weaker and was having a hard time just, you know, standing up for any length of time. And finally he lay down in bed and he couldn't really do much of anything. And so they managed to take him back up to Santa Cruz and they gave him some tests. I don't know what all they were. I guess they were sonograms and things. And here, he said the cancer had spread throughout his... throughout his body, liver, lungs, kidney, and they sent him back with, they say, 3 to 6 months to live. And it doesn't look like that's going to hold out because, he's just getting weaker and weaker. And when you call him up on the phone, Carolyn will, they put it on speakerphone, and then she kind of just, he hears what you say, and he was just talking in a whisper, just about like that. And so it didn't work very well with the phone. And when I heard that, I felt, well, I'm just going to go down there. I just feel I should go down there. And I wrestled around with that for a while. And start thinking, well, what good's that going to do? You stop and think, well, I can say the same thing over the phone. I don't have to disrupt the home and go get a plane ticket and fly all the way down there. So I'm going to be dead when I get there anyway. And, And it just reminded me of that verse about that we need to make sure we don't shut up our bowels of compassion. What I like about that is Paul's giving us the credit for having the Spirit of God within us. And when we see a need, there's something in us that looks at it, and there's something begins to flow. But that something that begins to flow always doesn't make sense, and it isn't always practical, and sometimes it's very expensive and very inconvenient, and we tend to, yes, they're good thoughts, and we start cranking that big valve down and crank it down till it's either shut off completely or just a little drizzle. Say, we can handle it at that level. But do you know what I'm talking about? Have you ever seen? I got to write that guy a letter. I got to write that brother a letter. I got to go over and visit him. And it's just not quite convenient enough. And finally, what percentage of the people that tell you something when you're in a conversation, you say, brother, I'm going to pray for you about that. What percentage of them do they get prayed for? What percentage of them do we seriously bring back to our conscience and pray? A brother here in this congregation taught me a lesson. We were talking about something was happening in my life. And I said, now, brother, you pray for me, okay? And I started, pray for me. And I start going like that and put his hand on my shoulder. I said, wait a minute. And he says, pray for you right now. And I appreciate that, because that's more real than the other thing. But anyways, so I went through a little struggle with that. And finally, he said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I started looking up some airlines. And now you go to Bolivia, they tightened it up. And if you're not a resident, you have to get a visa, which is not unusual, but you used to just be able to go down there and they would just automatically give you a visa and out you go. Now you have to have a letter of invitation. The letter of invitation has to have your name on it. In other words, written especially to you with your passport number, and they say they will provide lodging or be responsible for you during your stay in Bolivia. You need that letter, but you also, if they don't have the part where they're responsible for you while you're in Bolivia, you have to get a confirmation from a hotel for the length of your stay. So that's what it is. So I figured, well, that's the end of that. I said, I give up there. I'm free now. That's it. I give up. And then I thought, Aiden Troyers, they send a lot of people back and forth from Bolivia. I'm going to call him up, Aiden Troyer from Bern. So I called Aiden up, and that dear brother, he said, I'm going to call Nicholas, and he says, I'll get back to you. Nicholas Robertson's down in Bolivia. So Nicholas, he called me and gave me Nicholas's number, called Nicholas. He says, yeah, I know all about that. He says, give me some information, and I'll get that. So I said, okay. So their brother, just in like an hour and a half, there it was on my email, one in English, one in Spanish, and had that in my hand. Now I needed a ticket. Got the ticket. Next day, we were gone. Joshua Miller was driving me up to the airport, and off we went. Rough trip down, and a lot of, layovers and all that. We got there, and it's the end of the rainy season, and the rainy season in Bolivia is just rainy season in Bolivia. Roads are muddy and messy, and we got stuck a couple times, and they got out, and Doug, the driver and his helper, got out, and hose and shovels, and it's not just like, oh, you're stuck in the mud, but you're usually stuck, the roads are cut into the sides of the hills, and the hills are landsliding. I've never seen it that bad down there. I mean, the hills are just big channels wider than this church house down off. They just get so wet they just slip. And the roads are saturated and they're breaking off. So when you get close to the edge, you've got a chance of breaking off. And when you're stuck, of course, you're going like this. So it's very exciting. I'm glad I shared that first part with you in the beginning, that God knows right where we are and nothing's surprising him. But I'm glad he knew about where we were and slipping. But anyway, we made it all the way down to from Santa Cruz to Monte Agudo. And Monte Agudo is a town. It's probably 40, 50 miles maybe north of where we want to be. But that's kind of like almost home there. Well, as you come into Monte Agudo, you come in off a mountain and you're high up. And it's that part way up the mountain. It's quite a steep thing down into the city. And a truck was stuck there. And the truck was stuck against the mountain. But our driver thought he would be able to go around and be all right. Well, he got stuck. And then he started to try to get unstuck, backing up, going forward. Every time you do this business. And looking out, and it's not like you have a three-lane highway. The wheels, that's the edge, and the wheels are about here. And these banks are not stable. So everybody's knocking on the window, telling him, we want to get off. So... Well, he wasn't going to have that. He thought that's a black mark on him if everybody deserts him. But anyways, we shifted around and finally he got stuck, and he was convinced he was stuck, and he opened it up and we got out about 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, it's dark, rainy, it's muddy. So we get out and we walked a little ways and went down. There were steps here. And we were able to go down into the city, 2:30 in the morning. Nobody's moving around. And a taxi came by. Just happened. A taxi's coming by. So I got on that and went to the terminal. I got at the terminal at 2:30 in the morning. And the bus went out at 7. So anyway, we got down there with a few more getting stuck going down, but we got through them all. And got left off at Alfred's. And like I say, we left Tuesday, and I got there Thursday morning. So that's not too bad. I got there. That's what makes it good. But I was still questioning, is this really something that, God wanted? It's just my mind. And I went in, and he took me back to see Alfred. He just started, he put his, I bent down to talk to him. He just put his arm around my neck and pulled me down. And we just spent a little while just weeping together. And that was worth any inconvenience on my part. To know that it meant something to him, because it did to me. We had good times of sharing. Spent a lot of time with Alfred, and at first I'd sit by the bed, and probably if I had seen him day by day, it wouldn't have been such a shock, but I haven't seen him for a while, and he's lost a lot of weight, and a lot of the muscles have atrophied, or whatever you call that, where it shrinks, and it's quite a bit thinner. But we would share about the things of God, just all kinds of topics, and we would share together, and he would say, "Is he talking like this?" And I'm a little bit hard of hearing, so I have to, my head would be about this far away from him, and we'd be talking. And after about half an hour or so, he was talking about like this. And Carolyn and DeGrasse came in, and they said, they'd never seen him this encouraged in a long time. I mean, he was starting to get some response. He wasn't just laying there. He was getting kind of active, and his voice was normal. You could talk to him. And we just had a good time. Ed Yoder was there. I don't know if any of you know Ed Yoder. He has a children's home in Concepcion. That's up north and east of Santa Cruz. And he's been coming down now since Alfred's been sick about once a month. Stephen Mast is coming up from Entre Rios, which is south, about the same time. I think he's sending somebody from his congregation comes up about once every 2 weeks. So there's some things going on, and it's good. But Sunday morning, I didn't go to church. Alfred can't go, obviously, to church. So I stayed there, and we had a little service together, and Carolyn and Alfred and I, and it was a blessed time together. And then we had an anointing service for Brother Alfred. Not so much that, just in faith that that's what we're asked to do. And God certainly can heal him from a natural standpoint. There's, you know, with cancer throughout, and they have the photos of the growths and everything, but it's just, then be anointed in the name of the Lord. I'm hoping and praying that God will see fit to heal the brother. But in my mind, when that's done, we anoint him and pray for him, and he's in God's hands, and God's will be done for the very best for the family, for him, for all things considered, for God's plan, however we want to look at that. But the commitment's made. It's like, you know, God resisteth the proud and giveth grace unto the humble. Humble yourself, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, and he will raise you up. And then it tells us how, what he means by humbling ourselves, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. That's an important point in the Christian life, that he careth for you. That doesn't mean he's going to give you everything that feels good. It just means he knows where you are. He knows what you want. He knows what your needs are, and he knows his plan for you. And you can cast your care. Say, it doesn't feel good, God. It isn't the way I want to go. But we're holding this up to you, and we're making our requests known. Lord, we would pray for healing for the brother. But above all things, we just want to, in our hearts, hand him into your hands. Much better care there than he would ever get here. So, it was a blessed time. I wouldn't have traded it for... Well, I would have traded it for anything. I had already just said, no, I can't do that. But I learned one thing from that. I hope I don't forget. And that when God opens bowels of compassion, just let it flow and follow it as well as you can. And yeah, emotions can get you overboard, maybe, and this and that. But mainly, when God opens your heart toward a need, you're not going to go far wrong by going that way. You know, maybe people say, well, I think you went a little overboard. And I'd say, well, that's possible. But I leave those things in God's hands. If I'm going overboard, then God's just going to have to open that valve just a little bit less then, if he doesn't want me to do that much. But when he opens it up like that, I think that's what he wants us to do. Even as a congregation, we go out and we see needs, maybe in the community. Generally speaking, I would say that if God shows you a need, it's probably you he wants to do something about it. Now, some of the needs might be so large or whatever that you can't do it. You know, okay, well, then maybe share it with the brotherhood. But sometimes it's just, this person needs somebody to talk to him. You're somebody, aren't you? Follow what I'm saying? In other words, when you see something, there's something in your heart goes towards that. I would say, generally speaking, God probably wants you to do something about it. Not just refer it to a committee, but to get involved. Could be wrong. Well, when I was in Santa Cruz, come out of the airport, there's a lot of taxis there, so I called a taxi up, got in, and I figured here I have to struggle with my Spanish right away and trying to get words. So I told him in Spanish where I wanted to go, where it was. And he said, okay, well, that's not too big. Everybody knows okay, even people don't know English. And we started going down, and I asked him his name. He says, his name's Ozzy. And then he started talking to me in English. And I said, well, you know English? He says, yeah, I lived in New York. I was a taxi driver in New York for 6 years. So I said, that was nice. So we just had a nice conversation. And he's not a Christian, but he has a love for his family and seems to want to do good things, but he's not a Christian. And I left him not a Christian, but it's a shame. But it was interesting to me that I'd get a taxi driver, that was taxi driver in New York for 6 years. Well, I stayed with Milton Leah. They're doing well, they're busy, scratching to, you know, try to get things together, make some money down there. They've got some cows, chickens, making yogurt. And if you think of it sometime, pray for Leah, pray for Milton and Leah, but pray for Leah. I mean, that woman has to go from as soon as her eyes open in the morning till she closes them at night. I mean, she has about zero time. I mean, like I said, they're making yogurt, they're doing eggs, and she has to do a lot of the legwork. You know, Milt doesn't get around real good. Milt helps in the milking and all that, but so does she. And when milking's done, she's not. She's got to strain it and get it ready and all this kind of thing. So pray for her. She's got a busy agenda. But they were very hospitable, and of course I stayed in what was our house when we were down there, so it was almost like coming home. When I built the house, I wanted to put a good roof on it, so I thought about the best roof we could get was this corrugated asbestos. Put that up on there, you know, I figured that thing will be there for a long time. And I came in, and she said, now if it rains real hard, Joe, you might have some leakage in your room. There's a leak that comes down on the corner of the bed. And I said, well, why is it leaking? She said they had a hailstorm last year, and the hailstones were about as big as golf balls. And it tore everything up, and it punched a few holes in the roof. I wouldn't think that would have been possible, but it did. But anyways. Okay. What day was it? We left on Sunday after services, both Ed and I. We went back up to Santa Cruz. I wasn't flying out till Monday morning. But with the buses, if you get stuck and you miss your connection up in Monte Agudo, you're done. You miss your flight and you go through all that. So I figured I'm going to go up on Sunday afternoon, and we'll get up there by Monday morning. And then I can do a little shopping Monday and leave Tuesday. Everything will be fine. And Ed said, well, he says, we're having a gathering up in Santa Cruz, having a minister's meeting or leadership something or other. And he says, you're more than welcome to come. I'd like you to come. I said, no, I don't think I want to do that. And I kind of feel I'd be out of place not being, you know, in the ministry and that kind of thing. And he said, no, he said, I'd like you to come. And I said, well, I said, I don't think so. And then later on, I came to him and I said, you know, yeah, I think I would like to come at least for a little time. And I went there and I met some people from about three different congregations up that way. And they're young men. Of course, for me, I noticed a strange phenomenon. I don't see as many old men as I used to. I see a lot more young men. I don't know what's going on. Well, I think I do, but anyway. But they looked young to me. You know, I don't know how old they really were. I probably late 20s. Maybe some of them a little older than that. I don't know. But they come out of an old colony setting, which I guess is somewhat like old Mennonite or old order Mennonite or Amish, old order Amish. And yeah, they're really, really on fire. I mean, They want something. They've got a vision. And I was sitting there, and we were waiting for Stephen to come. It turned out later he couldn't make it, or made only toward the end of the day, I guess. But he wasn't there. And we were sitting there, and Ed introduced me, and they could speak English, and that was nice. So we were talking, and they started asking me questions, you know. Well, how, you know, what do you think is some things to be looked at, you know, in a congregation that we thrive and don't have to go through this perpetual tension and then dividing off and all that? And I said, if I had the answer to that, that would be really great. I said, I've got some thoughts and certainly some points that are good. And they were all ears, so I started talking and shared some things that I'll share with you in the time we have, and because I think they're true. I think some of them I have shared, but I don't think I've ever sat with people that were so attentive, writing down. I mean, they wanted to hear, and hopefully they want to put into practice, and I hope they just don't take things I said as that's the way it is. Go search and see if these things be true, you know, and we had a good time sharing together, talking about a lot of different things. The congregation's names are Tres Cruces, and there was three crosses. I think Mose is connected with that in some way. I think that's where his clinic is. I don't know how close the congregations are to the clinic or, you know, what affiliations they have. And then Chihuahua was another one, and then where Ed is Concepcion. And then, of course, Entre Rios would have been up if Stephen had been there. And generally, Alfred would have been there, and that's, of course, from Wacoretta. So the thing that enthuses me is maybe 6 months ago, I talked to a New Order bishop. I wanted to meet him because I heard he was going to Bolivia. Any of you know Stephen Hirschberger? Yeah. Yeah, you know, you took me there. Yeah, and he's there. And I don't know just where his congregation is, but I tell you that if you want to start a fire, I can't think of a better place to start a fire than right there, that old colony Mennonite. It's just a dry, just a very dry setting. And they've got Stephen Hirschberger down there, and they got these young brothers from Tres Cruces in Chihuahua. I think you're going to hear some exciting things from down there. I'm looking forward to hearing it. But if that gets going, that's going to be a big blaze. Couldn't ask for better fuel. And these are brethren that are just not looking for a few liberties. These people are looking for truth. They're looking for God's way. They want to be a follower of the Lamb in truth. And may God bless them in that. I hope they don't get their eyes taken away by other things. So, well, we were there. And they would ask me questions like that. And what they were going to study, I didn't know, but or what they were going to go over. And they asked me, first of all, you know, what do you think makes tension in the churches? Well, you know, a lot of different things. I said one thing would be you could look back in Ephesians chapter 4 and starting in verse 1, and Ed looked at me, and he says, that's what we're going to talk about for Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11. We want to go over to 5 gifts to the church. And I said, good. I said, that's really good. But one thing as you go over it, remember that whole thought about chapter 11 and the 5 gifts is introduced by the word but. You say, what? So we turn back there and we read down, which we'll do right now, Ephesians chapter 4. You know, I explained, this is not the only source of problems, but this is one tension that comes in churches. Sometimes it's very easy to discern, sometimes it's not easy to discern. But the heading on this chapter in my Bible says, relationships with other believers. It says, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation with wherewith you're called. Well, that presents a truth too. Walking worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called. What's our vocation? What's the job we're called to? What's the work we're called to? And if we don't get that one straight, we're probably not going to get anything else straight. If you don't understand your work or your job, how are you going to do the right things? How are you going to tool up? How are you going to put into operation any kind of comprehensive plan of working? How are you going to relate to one another if you don't know what you're doing? What are you doing? Well, I'm not quite sure. Well, can I help you? Well, I'm not quite sure about that either. How would you help me? Well, I'm not quite sure. Well, we're not quite sure because we don't understand what our vocation is. And I'm not going to say it because it's a multifaceted thing. But in short, it's living in response to Christ in you, the hope of glory, and fulfilling commission to the church of taking the gospel out. And it's by the church the manifold wisdom of God is going to be known. So is our lives, is our little congregation manifesting the wisdom of God to those that are looking on? Can they say, aha, yes, I can see why God called those people out of darkness into his marvelous light. I can see because they're walking in it. I mean, it's just a good thing. So if we don't get that one straight from the beginning, what our vocation is, those of you in business probably know it a lot better than what I do, but things change. And what was a good vocation yesterday, if we don't understand what the vocation is, we're going to get messed up, like the Pony Express. If your business was the Pony Express, your time was limited. If your business was delivering packages and messages in the most efficient way possible, in fact, the Pony Express goes out of business, the railroad there, you don't care. That's the quickest way. That's the best way. And that's, you adjust your business to that. Later, there's planes. Well, then sometimes for certain packages, planes are more expedient. Sometimes the trains are. So you do it because you're not locked in. You didn't put yourself in a little box. And you could say the same thing about boxes. Well, if you were a box maker in the old days, and every little town had their box makers, so you got box makers here. But box makers is kind of, there's still specialized products that want wooden boxes, but now cardboard, plastic. Well, if you're a box maker, you'd be just like all the other box makers throughout the United States. They're out of business. If they saw themselves as box makers, if they saw themselves as container makers, yeah, maybe they prefer wooden boxes, but they're container makers. Well, as soon as other material comes, it's more efficient and better and everything else. That's what it is. They don't have any attachment to wood. Can you follow, get what I mean? And if our business is edifying one another, building each other up, helping each other, reaching the lost, depends what our, or is it maintaining a certain air? That's not your vocation. Your vocation is maintaining a certain life within. And yes, it will express itself, but it will express itself in a consistent way. You follow what I'm saying? It all depends what your vision is. What's our vision of our vocation? So that's going to be a help, and if we get it wrong, it's going to be a great hindrance to being faithful. we don't really understand what I am called to be or what the church is called to be. When you understand what you're called to be, then you have a target. And it's very easy to discern when we're going this way or that way. But if we really don't know, or we got the wrong picture, we become just curiosities, things to be stared at, and for buses to come around and say, oh, there goes one of them now, look. That's not what we're called to. We're called for people to see and say, there goes one of them now, I just talked with him. What a blessing that was. What a sweetness. What a willingness to give themselves. If we don't get our vocation right, beloved, we're in trouble right from the go. That's what encouraged me about those. I hope they get their vision straight and build according to the vision they have. Okay, well, then you have with all lowliness and meekness. The little word humility gives me a problem. I'm not basically a humble person. I have every reason to be. I mean, I have every reason to be humble. You know, in one sense of the word, it's a good thing. It's a good thing God didn't call us to be proud. You know, be confident of yourself, you know, and be assertive and all those things, and be proud. If you were honest with yourself, say, how am I going to do that? Me? How am I going to be confident and assertive and get my opinion across to others all the time? How am I going to do that? But we're called to something we're perfectly fitted for. He's calling us to humility, Brother John. That's something we're just perfectly committed. If we're honest, say, I can't think of something, I can't think of a better calling for me than just to be humble and have some humility about me and not think that everything I say is going to be right. You'd have ears open to others. What a blessing that is if our ears are open to other people, just to hear them. And we'll get to that one a little more in depth in a few minutes. But anyway, we went through this, and it says, now listen, here's something God does to every believer. Every believer that receives the Spirit of God has this. Everyone. God does not miss one. There'll be some that don't have it. But everyone that is born the Spirit of God is going to have this. And then here he says it. With all lowliness, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. Now he says, there is one body, there is one Spirit, there is one hope of your calling, there is one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all, through all, and in you all. He says, that's something you can relate to. Well, we found ingenious ways of arguing about those things and fine-tuning them and making it so important that we do it just exactly this way, exactly that way. But what he's saying is everybody understands these things are for everybody. Everybody. Verse 7 introduces the gifts, and it says, but. But unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of Christ. Wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts unto men. Now he that ascended, what is it? But he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth. He that descended is the same also that ascended up far above all heavens, that he might fill all things. And now he says, and he gave some. Now there's a big difference. Before it's everyone. He says, but he gave some apostles. These are the five gifts he was talking about. He gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors, some teachers. Now, I know we're going to jump around about the thought of apostles. That's fine. Titles isn't where it is. What's important is the responsibility, the job. God is going to give some that are going to be church planters. They're going to be going around. They're going to be doing the work that we would consider what the apostles did. We can say, okay, maybe we can say not under the same power. I'm not going to argue with that. But that's a function, and it's still here. Prophets. Some prophets. Not all prophets. Some prophets. Some evangelists. Some pastors. Some teachers. Not all. Some. And of course, there's a possibility of, if you're particularly gifted in an area, to think that that area is of very much importance, which it is. But it isn't of exclusive importance. It's of corporate importance. It fits into a picture that God has. But we might think, while we accept that, we think that the piece is a lot bigger than what it really is. Well, if you get a pie and you start doing that, finally you get a couple pieces that are getting squeezed out of shape. It doesn't feel good to get squeezed out of shape. So there's pushback. And sometimes I think that can be a source of problems, that we recognize gifts, and I think in this congregation it's a beautiful thing the way it's done. I think gifts are recognized and used just because they're there, which is the way it's supposed to be. But it can cause some problems sometimes. And then it goes on. It's for the perfecting of the saints, work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come into the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God and a perfect man under the measure and the stature of the fullness of Christ. So it's for the good of the body that these gifts are given. They need to be recognized, and where they aren't recognized, we have some problems. You can go back over to 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and read about the gifts. When these are different gifts, these are more a little more specialized type of things. And one thing that'll strike you, it's the same Lord. Read through there and just study how it says, the same Spirit, the same Lord, the same God, to profit with all, the same Spirit, the same Spirit. All these are the same Spirit, severally as he will. I'm just reading a lot of words here for you, but you go back and study that and see, what are these gifts all about? And you see they're about the body. They're not about you. They're not about you're puffed up. It's about these things are given that the body can be edified. And when those things are given in such a way or received in such a way where the body isn't edified, but the individual is built up and swelled, something's wrong. And you can go back to the humility part. It has to be received with humility. And they're all there to be used to profit with all. That's talking about the body. It's used to profit the body. And when one aspect gets out of balance, there's not profiting, there's just pushing and shoving a little bit. That's not edification. But God has it for the body that all the gifts are focused on one thing, and that's that Christ's body be edified. You can go over and look where Paul reckons it like a natural body. This member, that member, the least member, the strongest member. But it's just like our body. You know, if we can get a picture of that, and I don't know what part of the body you are or I am, but whatever it is, we don't have to know. I don't know if the stomach knows it's a stomach, but it does know what its work is. And I don't know, you know, if the ears really understand where they are or, you know, anything else. They're just there, and they do their job. So all these gifts are by one Spirit for one purpose, and they're given to us by God for the edification of his body for the work that is to be done. And we go right back again to what is the work that should be done? Answer that question, and you'll have a real good idea of what your purposes are and what your decisions should be and what you should value most and what you shouldn't even value at all. Romans 15. We just touched on this a little bit. Says in, I have to turn back there. Romans 15, 14. This is, try to keep this in mind. I'm not just saying this to us. I'm just trying to share with you what was shared there together in the response to some of the questions they were asking. Then he says, I myself am also persuaded of you, my brethren, that you are also full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able to admonish one another. Well, we're able to admonish one another, aren't we? That comes pretty easy. Not if we understand what admonish means. We're able to scold one another or, you know, say things to them. But able to admonish, that means to move them in the, make a correction in where they're going. Well, that's easy. Just tell them you don't go that way anymore. You don't make those decisions. You go this way and you make these decisions. Well, that may be true, but you're not going to get people to go that way just by doing that. You need to spend a little time, and that's why he says able to admonish. In other words, you understand that your brothers have reasons for what they do. If you just try to correct their decisions, you can do it, you know, if you really threaten and all that, but that's, you're not accomplishing anything. If you buy the fact that we don't just arbitrarily do things, like, you know, like reflex your eye closes, it's not that. Things we do and the decisions we make are usually because we've thought about them. And we found something that agrees with our understanding and with our appetites, and we decide we're going to do it. Able to admonish, I think, means able to talk to somebody in such a way, in calmness, and for the right motives, and finding out why they're doing. And you don't just come and say, why are you doing that? That's not what I'm talking about. Just talking to them. And one question leads to another, and you just try to find out why without saying why. Why is a very nice little word. I mean, it can get you answers. If people answer honestly, it's a great question. You did your children. I don't want you to do that. Why, Dad? Well, because you'll leave the rake outside. Okay. No, Dad, I won't leave the rake outside. Well, we'll give you one more chance. But anyways, why is a very powerful word. It gets you down to the bone real quick, doesn't it? I'm not going to do this. Why? Because I don't want to do why. Pretty soon you're down there and you're at the end. So you want to know why, but you don't want to say it that way. What I'm saying, just to know the person and share with him. And if you can uncover why, truly, why a person is making the decision they make, then you have a shot at helping them see and move it over. If you don't get to why and you just look at the decision and you want to say it's not a good decision, it should be this, you may get a change, you may not. But the best change is a change where you've got hold of the why, and you say, okay, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. But look at this. Look at consequence, and look at this other why, and the consequence of that. Oh, then you've got something. Able to admonish, not just recognize and criticize, but recognize and enter in and start the dialogue. How many of you like to be understood? I do. I like to be understood. In fact, I like to be understood so much that when I have a problem with somebody, I want them to understand exactly what I'm looking at and why I'm saying what I'm saying. And that's any, you know, anything else just doesn't even make any sense. Well, some people, you'll get pretty far with that, maybe. You'll be able to pull them over. But generally speaking, if you can get a person to open up, and this is like in a congregational setting, if you can get somebody to open up and share with you, and you won't get it by running in there and saying, why are you doing that? But just by talking and finding where their values and trying very hard, honestly, to really understand why. Because there is a why. Maybe you won't be able to do it. But if you can come in without banging on their door and trying to get them to open the door, because all they'll do is put a chair up against it if you're trying to get in. But if you stand back there and just talk through the door and just say, you know, why, you know, and get to know why. If you can get to understand somebody, then you can understand what the problem is. You can understand the answer. I probably shared this. I'm sure I shared it here before. I'll just share it again anyway because I like the story. Have you ever seen a video of a demolition project? Big buildings near other buildings. They're going to take it down. How they all grab a stick of dynamite and they all stand by one window and they light it and they throw it in and run and hope the thing doesn't blow up and hurt anybody else. That's not how they do it. They get the engineer's renderings and they go back and they study those things, where the girders are. They see how it has to fall. And they do calculations as to how much powder, where. And it doesn't all go boom at once. They may have to blow the back wall 0.2 seconds before the front wall. They have timed fuses, and sometimes they use cables from the top of one wall to the bottom of another and blow the bottom. And this one brings it down, this one caves it. It's an amazing thing. And then you see the end results of it. You see the building sitting there, and all of a sudden, boom. And it falls in place, or it takes over on one side, whatever they need. But it's not by accident. They didn't just come in and say, that building has to come down, and boom, 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 and it, you know, creates all kinds of damage and hurts people, and that happens. Sometimes we can clearly see, this has to come out of here. Boom! You know, and well, there's other people laying around, people get blown right out of the congregation, and that kind of thing. Now, I know this is an oversimplification, but the thought is, how about spending a little time studying why the person's off base? Sometimes you'll find that not only are they off base, but I'm off base too, and the truth lies here. So it's good for us. So I don't know if that's making all sense to you. But it's not going to hurt you. If you're right, if you're really right, it's not going to hurt you to sit down and try to understand the person. Try to really understand. Because once you understand, if they are truly wrong, and that building really has to come down, you'll know exactly where to go. You'll know exactly how long the fuse has to be. You'll know exactly how big a charge to put, where to put it, and it'll come down. But if you just go in and start throwing dynamite around just because it has to come down, it's going to be a lot of hurt. And I've hurt people. Many of the lessons I've learned isn't from wisdom. It's from failure. Many of the lessons I've learned have come through not doing it the right way and then understanding what the right way was. Not a good way to learn, beloved. That's a fool learning by experience. God's way, method of learning, is by instruction. You say experience is the best teacher. It's a very effective teacher, but it's the very most expensive teacher you can have. God's chosen way is be wise and listen up. Open your eyes and listen. Open your eyes and read and pray about it. And take instruction. Right? Most of my lessons have been learned just the other way. Very effective way of learning, but very, very costly. If it was just costly to myself, that'd be one thing. But it's costly to others too. So be wise. Be understanding. Cast your cares upon Him. Consider who we are, what we cost, and who we represent, and what our vocation is, what our calling is. Remember the past graces of God in your life, like from Brother Dirk's opening, and apply them to the present ones. It's the same God. He hasn't changed. And we can safely trust Him. God bless you all.